the SEO summit, you wrote a piece on your website, The Dawning of a New World Order.
Right.
What has happened and how did you find the SEO summit?
Well, I haven't seen all, you know, it finished up overnight while I was in bed. So I didn't have somebody sitting there dictating to me. Actually, the funniest thing was that, you know, the photograph I showed of the meeting of Modi with Putin and Xi, there was a period where they were laughing. And so all these memes are starting to pop up on the internet of them laughing. Like, for example, one of them goes, Putin to Modi, man, can you believe that Macron is married to a dude? Or Putin tells Modi, yeah, my grandfather died in his sleep on a bus. And Modi goes, oh, I'm so sorry. He says, yeah, he died peacefully. Too bad for the other passengers. You know, but it shows that, you know, so these were not laughs from, you know, trying to be polite. These were genuine belly laughs. So I don't know what they were talking about. But when you see those three, particularly India and China, laughing together, that's good news. Because previously they were like getting ready to launch nuclear weapons at each other. And the, you know, the tensions that have existed between those two countries for several years, which the United States was gleefully trying to exploit. And now the United States finds itself on the outside looking in. Because the, you know, this SCO originally was sort of a, it was a meeting of China and the former Soviet republics, principally. They were the main body of it. But now others are getting invited in. The one I thought was fascinating that showed up, or the three, were Turkey, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And while Azerbaijan was at the SCO, Russia just blew up one of their ships that was hauling weapons into Ukraine. So, you know, maybe Aliyev will have something to talk to Putin about, or Putin will remind him. He just said, you know, FAFO. I'd like to figure out what FAFO is in Russian. You know, I'll have to go onto Google Translate, start using that as the acronym. That'll be what Putin shared with Aliyev. But the start of it, I did get the initial sort of remarks from Xi, and he said, hey, we're not going to put up with this bullying anymore. You know, we're going to chart a new security order. So this is the work of SCO is really going to complement BRICS. And the irony, it's not so much irony, but Modi shows up at this as the new, you know, sort of acting president of BRICS for the next year. Just as, you know, last year around this time, they were in Kazan for the BRICS summit. And that's when the mantle fell upon Brazil and we were worried, oh boy, Brazil's going to drop the ball on this. And they almost did. But now Modi enters it with, both critical support from the other BRICS nations and the other most and all of the SCO nations, because they're in a confrontation and showdown with the United States. And these idiot advisors around Trump, particularly Peter Navarro, too bad they didn't keep him in jail. You know, they're convinced that they're going to tell India what to do, because this is all about hurting Russia. And these countries, they've had enough. And so they're coming together at a time that the United States, its foreign policy under Putin, under Trump, is how many people can we piss off today? Who can we alienate? It's crazy.
What's amazing, Larry, 2 days ago, I talked with you and before about this article in the Politico. There was an article arguing that the next 5 years, the escalation that could happen, one of them was between China and India.
Ah, yeah, I know.
It's unbelievable.
Listen, within the foreign policy establishment here in the United States, and I'm saying this for most of your foreign viewers, that they'll appreciate and understand what's going on here. There are sort of two myths that continue to dominate. If you're attending any of these academic forums or these policy presentations, you're going to run into this. Myth number one, Russia is just it's the stepchild to China. It's just there for convenience sake right now, but it really doesn't like the Chinese, and the Chinese are going to dominate it anyway. Russia's so small and so insignificant. So, you know, we got to make Russia our friend so they can work with us so we can defeat China. Elbridge Colby, the deputy number two guy at the Department of Defense, has written about it extensively. Aaron Wes Mitchell did a paper we talked about before that was in the National Interest along those lines. RAND Corporation in 2019 spelled it out, you know, about how to split Russia from China. And what the combination of Joe Biden and Donald Trump have accomplished is they've brought China and Russia together in a relationship that is historic. Historic because at no time in the long history of both countries. So with Russia, you go back 1,000 years. And with the Chinese, I'm not sure I got enough fingers on my hands to count how far back. But they now are integrated, and both economically, politically, financially, and militarily, they are sharing. So they're, you know, this is a broad-based cooperation. And now in Russian schools, for example, kids, it's expected that they learn to speak Chinese. So that's, you know, it's not an esoteric course for only a few people. It's one everyone's expected. Hey, you're going to learn another language. You're going to learn Chinese. So that's the first myth. The second myth is that there's no way India and China can get along. And what do? Do the Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence organizations do everything we in our power to try to exacerbate or set that confrontation afire? You know, anything we can do to provoke the separation of those two, the better. We don't want them working together. God, they might do something beneficial for the world. We can't have that. So, but these are concepts that people sit around and talk about it, you know, in these open forum and on the cable news shows that, like, yeah, you know, in fact, when I go on to say what, you know, I won't be allowed on, but if I was allowed to go on and say what I'm saying, man, they'd treat me like I had leprosy.
It wasn't just about China and India, Larry. They had the same sort of argument about Russia and China as well, about Iran and Russia being they don't like each other. They are, after all, they are some sort of enemies historically, but it shows that you look at the picture right now, you see how the world is changing before our eyes. China and Russia, it's something, I think for the establishment in the United States, still, they don't believe what's
going on. They're saying, no, I'm not seeing that. That's got to be artificial intelligence. But, you know, it's not just that they're meeting and they're talking, they're also doing. So when China purchases Russian oil, 10 years ago, when that happened, and it was, you know, it wasn't in the quantities that it is now, if China wanted to buy Russian oil, they'd have to take the Chinese RMB and they would go to the international financial market and buy dollars. And then they'd pay those dollars. The dollars would get transferred to Russia via SWIFT, you know, and it would get deposited in a Russian account. That's not happening today. They're not buying those dollars. And so the demand for the dollar is going down. Now, it's not so dramatic that it's dropped 20 or 30%, but you know what? It is like how floodwaters take down a wall. If they're running outside that wall, first comes off one piece of concrete, then another piece of concrete, then another. So pieces start coming off, and it doesn't appear serious until you, all of a sudden, it does reach a point where the structural integrity of that wall has been breached, and boom, it falls over. That's where this the U.S. dollar-dominated financial system is headed, because you know Russia and China are going outside that. China and Brazil are going outside that. India with Russia is going outside that. India with other BRICS countries is going to go outside that. So all of a sudden, these countries, you know, so China, Russia, and India are major countries, and as is Brazil. You know, South Africa is not in the same league with them in terms of an economy. But now that they're all starting to use currencies other than the dollar for settling international trade, it is a threat to the U.S. dominance of this financial system. Now, they've insisted publicly that, you know, no, we're not out trying to replace the dollar, no. But you know, it's not like they're going to set up a new currency, which will just be, you know, a BRICS currency. But they are saying, we're not going to any longer be in the position where you, the United States, can bully us, threaten us, sanction us, hurt us, and use your dollar as a club to beat us. No, that's going to stop. And the U.S. actions in the wake of the start of the special military operation in February 2022, that's where this initial fuse was lit. And I wrote about it back then. And all of a sudden, the fire has spread. It's growing. And it's going to come a point. I don't know, is it going to be next year? Is it going to be in 5 years? Where the U.S. will no longer be sitting atop the heap controlling this. And at that point, we're going to have to change how we act and how we interact with other countries. Do we treat them with respect and as equals, or do we continue our new form of neocolonialism and, you know, try to rule over them?
I think the main point would be, what is bringing all these countries together? The only point is their economy is bringing them. Their economy is totally important for their security, for their growth, for the future of the country. And it doesn't seem that is that fact is appreciated in Washington.
Oh no.
Because you cannot imagine China without the energy coming from Russia and Iran. You cannot imagine Russia without the help of BRICS, because we know how BRICS was important in the fight in Ukraine, because they wanted to put the pressure the way that to crush Russia, to just destroy Russia. But the BRICS didn't get along with that plan. India right. said no to the Biden administration, not to Trump administration.
Right, right. Yeah, it is, we're at a transition phase in the world where the countries that have been exploited by the colonial empires, by Europe and by the United States, I put the United States in that same colonial empire. We like to pretend that we're the world's best friend and we're sitting on a hill celebrating democracy, when we're one of the biggest damn invaders in history, and the death tolls we've racked up of other people is significant. But you look also in Africa across the Sahel. These countries that used to be exploited by France in particular are kicking them out and taking control of their own natural resources. You know, one of the things that has been the hallmark of the West is to go into a country. Oh, we'll invest here with you. We'll help you with that gold mine. But then, hey, we're going to sign it over to us. And all of a sudden, those countries, you don't see the development of infrastructure. You don't see the development of the people in terms of having a solid middle class, people with, you know, a consumer society where they can live and with a decent infrastructure, good roads, good sewer and water systems, so the population's healthy, good electricity. The colonial empires did not promote that. And they always dealt with these Africans in particular, you know, these black people, you know, they're stupid. They don't know, you know, they're animals. Well, they've had enough. And now they're recognizing, you know what, we're going to take control of these resources and use them for our people. Now, are there some leaders that are corrupt and going to take advantage for themselves? Yeah, absolutely. That exists here in the United States. So, you know, we're in no position to go around pointing at others and lecturing them. Hey, you know, you need to clean your act up and be like us. Oh, you mean like, you know, all the presidents that have gone into office not as multimillionaires, and when they leave office, they're multimillionaires? Yeah, great system. Bill Clinton is, you know, the poster boy for that, as is Barack Obama. Two of the worst examples. So, you know, we got the corruption on this side of the aisle, but we're always out lecturing other countries. So they're now starting to break away from that. I would not be surprised to see an alternative set up to the United Nations, or that there's going to be a confrontation with respect to the United Nations. There's no reason in the world that France and England should sit in two of the most important seats on the UN Security Council where they can veto anything. France and England, or the United Kingdom, are irrelevant countries. Yeah, they've got, through the financial system, you know, the Rothschild banking influences, the European money there. Yeah, they've got some influence, but militarily, economically, they're a joke. They're an absolute joke. They don't produce anything of great note. You know, France produces great wines and champagne. Ooh, some good cheeses. But in terms of natural resources or modern technology that's changing the world, no. That's all happening in China. And, you know, in the West, this myth continues to perpetuate. Oh, the Chinese just have that because they stole it from us. You know, the Chinese are doing things on an industrial scale the United States can't match at all. And it's like, stop with this arrogance where we've got to assume, well, we're Americans, we're the best of all. You know, I have been proud to be an American, because there was a point where I thought we were really sincere about trying to help the oppressed, trying to stand up for freedom and liberty. Now, as I've gotten older, I've realized it's all been a damn scam. They've used that meme and both bamboozled a bunch of very good-hearted people into believing it, when the folks that really are at the heart of the deep state and the key in these financial institutions, they don't believe that at all. We're just something that can be used.
Larry, do you feel that China, what was the main goal of China? What was the main objective of China in communicating? Because they invited Armenia. Somehow, it was amazing to me to see Armenia, Azerbaijan there. Do you think that they're having some sort of honest discussions, sincere yes. discussions about the region?
Oh, yes. I think they were informed probably in no uncertain terms that, look, here's the reality. Our economy is growing. The U.S. economy is not. The U.S. is aligned with Europe. Europe is in decline. But this is the future here. You're a small, and to, particularly to Armenia and to Azerbaijan, you are very small countries. Not that you're insignificant, but that if you decide that you're going to align with the West and align yourself with countries that want to attack and bully us, then, you know, that's your choice. But understand that such choices come with consequences. So I don't think they were there to threaten them. They weren't going to turn around and do a sort of what I call, you know, take off, act, pretend like they're dressed up as Chinese, but they're really acting like the United States. Take the mask off. Hi, it's Uncle Sam, and this is what you're going to do. No. I think they try to, you know, convey, we'll deal with you respectfully on a on an equal basis, even though you're a very tiny, tiny country, Armenia in particular, with 2.8, 3 million people, tops. Hell, that's a neighborhood in Beijing, okay? So it was maybe to sort of show them, let us show you what the real opportunities are for economic cooperation, because with China's Belt and Road Initiative, they're putting money where their mouth is, and they're actually out helping other countries build up infrastructure. Yeah, well, the Chinese, you get to use that infrastructure and help China. Absolutely. And do the Chinese, are they, you know, I love it over this on this side. Of the side. Well, they're ruthless in getting control of supply chains. No, they're smart. They're not idiots like we have been. Okay. But in doing so, they're not acting like that monopoly boss where, you know, we got you by the balls and you do what we want and we're going to squeeze, you know.
Donald Trump, this isn't about national security policy. This isn't about foreign policy. This is about domestic policy. Donald Trump is trying to appease a domestic audience and several domestic audiences at the same time. He has his base who says they're tired of American money being sent off to fund Ukraine. And then he has his political opposition, or what I would say the traitors among us, those who claim to be supportive of Donald Trump, but who actually vehemently oppose any policy that would bring an end to this conflict on terms acceptable to the Russian Federation. And so he has to go through, you know, these very complicated machinations. He doesn't care about the dead because he doesn't know how to count the dead. He just repeats numbers that are given to him by people. If he cared about the dead, then he truly wanted to know what the reality is and understand why reality matters. He lives in a fantasy land where Russia is losing more manpower than Ukraine, where the Ukrainians are losing manpower at a sustainable rate, meaning that Ukraine has the potential of continuing this conflict. Russia, according to his numbers, is not able to sustain this. Therefore, the concept of continuing this war to put pressure on Russia seems to make sense to him. But the fact of the matter is we now know that 1.7 million Ukrainians are dead or missing. I think there's a couple hundred thousand of those who could be missing, but they're probably dead. That number is going to go up because if, you know, according to the same leaked data out of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, 625,000 of those dead / missing are this year alone. That's 90,000 a month. And that number is going up higher because Russia's just dominating. So this means that every month, another 90, soon to be 100,000 Ukrainians are dying or disappearing. Those are big numbers. If Trump cared about Ukraine, he'd say we have to bring this war to an end because those numbers are only going to get worse. Russia's numbers are big, but not that big. Right now, it's estimated that, you know, Russia's losing, you know, one dead for every 10, 13, 15 Ukrainian dead. So, you know, the Russian numbers are far less than the Ukrainian numbers. Still big numbers. I mean, I'm not saying Russia's having a cakewalk here. This is hard fighting. This is some of the most high intense combat that's been seen since the Second World War. At least Donald Trump gets that aspect of it right. And he's starting to understand that it's a new kind of war. He spoke the other day about drone warfare and the reality of drone warfare. But, you know, he can't allow himself to be painted into a corner, meaning that he caved into Russia. So he has to say stupid things and do stupid things. This is why the other day he posted on social media about Ukraine needed to have the ability to attack Russia. Nobody ever won a war on the defense. You have to have the ability to attack. He coupled that then with an announcement that the United States, it was reported in the Wall Street Journal, is going to sell 3,000 some odd extended range, you know, attack missiles, or I don't know what the A stands for, to Ukraine. And on the surface of it, you say, well, what? Because wasn't it Donald Trump who realized back in December of 2024 that the Biden administration's green lighting of use of ATACMS missiles targeting the Russian strategic debt brought us to the brink of nuclear war? Trump recognized that, then that's why he said, I won't continue that policy. Now he's doing that policy, just using a different weapon system. But let's parse this out, because that's what he said. He's posturing right now so that nobody can say, you're not supporting Ukraine. He said, no, we're just not paying for it. But NATO's paying for it. Remember those 10 Patriot batteries that they were going to provide? The full complement. I mean, I love that term, the full complement. It's so wholesome. It makes you feel really good and safe and secure. And now I guess we're providing with the full complement of ERAM missiles too. But those Patriot batteries will never be delivered to Ukraine. First of all, they have to be produced. You have to get in line. There's a lot of people looking for Patriot batteries and Patriot missiles. Israel used a whole bunch of them, needs replacements. The United States doesn't have any left. We need to beef up our forces. So once we start producing them and we get them to Europe so they can transfer them to Ukraine, we're talking 2027, 2028. There won't be a Ukraine by then. It's not going to last much longer. The ERAM, it was a system conceived in 2023. It didn't exist. In fact, it doesn't exist. I mean, they've spent 2 years developing it. I think it might have passed its last trial, but it's not in serial production yet. That means that if you're building it, you're building one ofs for testing purposes. They're not designed to be given to Ukraine yet. And yet in 6 weeks, Donald Trump says he'll begin delivery. That means that let's assume, to make that announcement, the system now has passed its final, you know, evaluation. The maximum output that the United States will have with everything going full speed is 1,000 missiles a year. That means that to get to what Donald Trump is, we're talking at least 3.5 years down the road before that full complement gets there. But some missiles may be delivered, a handful, a dozen starting. But then there's the fine print. Ukraine can't use these missiles without America's permission. Only America gets to designate the targets. And if you think Donald Trump is going to allow the United States to designate targets for the ERAM missiles, knowing that in doing so, you close the door on any peace possibility because you become a direct participant in the war, that isn't going to happen. Everything gets pushed off 6 months. I think Donald Trump is hoping that in 6 months there will be a new reality on the ground, one that compels the Ukrainians to accept the Russian terms without compromise. It can bring this war to an end. Otherwise, you know, this war will continue until Russia accomplishes all of its objectives. And unfortunately, to get those objectives, Russia will be called upon to destroy the Ukrainian army. There's 800,000 of them in there today. I think Russia, by the time this is finished, will end up killing another 250,000-300,000 Ukrainians. That's just the way this cookie crumbles. That's the way war goes. So, this is the reality. Donald Trump is saying things, but the reality is nothing of substance is going to be delivered. Donald Trump has bigger fish in mind. He has a strategic nuclear treaty he's trying to revive with the Russians. He's trying to come up with, you know, profitable joint enterprises, joint exploitation, exploration of the Arctic. I think it was Chevron just basically was greenlit to go back into the Russian oil business. you know, Trump said, yeah, we're friendly to that. That's, you know, billions of dollars. And after Chevron will come other American energy giants that will get back into the Russian market. This is what Donald Trump cares about. He doesn't care about Ukraine. In fact, today, or I think yesterday, he said, you know, what did Ukraine expect going to war with Russia? They got their butts kicked. He recognizes that reality. It's just a political game that's being played right now because there's a tremendous amount of opposition inside the United States, in Europe, and colluding between Europe and the United States to prevent Donald Trump from having better relations with Russia. And unfortunately, these people who oppose better relations with Russia are willing to sacrifice Ukraine to achieve, you know, their outcome. And when I say sacrifice, I mean literally sacrifice Ukraine. They're destroying the genetic pool of Ukraine. Soon they'll be sending 18-year-olds to the front line. And when they do that, that's it. Ukraine's finished as a race because you'll have a bunch of women and you won't have any men left. And now we get into sort of a sensitive topic. But Russia has a demographic problem. You see Russia passing laws right now to encourage childbirth amongst the Russian people because they have a declining population. And because of the conflict in Ukraine and because of the expansion of NATO, Russia's had to increase the size of its military. Now it's up to 1.3. It's probably going to get up closer to 1.6 by the time the expansion is done, 1.6 million under arms. And this takes people out of the workforce. So you see Russia now, you know, talking about, hey, can we bring in Indians? Can we bring in, you know, outsiders into our workforce? The Russians would love nothing more than to have NATO just say, we're a defensive organization again, we're back to our roots, you know, and we will, you know, behave accordingly. I think you'd see Russia start dropping the size of its military quickly, because then it can take those that manpower and put it back into the workforce. The workforce then that will be well-paid. What happens when you have a well-paid workforce? They get married. You know, give a guy some money, he finds himself a pretty girl, and next thing you know, he has a house and some kids. That's what the Russians need. They have these great family values, but it's hard to raise a family if you're in the military. That's not the best place in the world to raise a family. Maybe as an officer, a senior officer, but if you're an enlisted man, if you're out there in the ranks, no, it's disruptive as hell. And the Russians are moving away from a conscript system to a contract system. So we're talking about long-term, you know, contracts. We call them enlistments here in the United States. But again, you're going to be in the business of preparing for war, training for war. You're not home raising a family. You're not producing anything. So anybody who sits there and says, no, the Russians want to really build up their military and really do it, they don't understand Russia. It's not what Russia wants at all. It's the exact opposite of Russia wants. Russia will do what Russia needs to do to protect itself. There's no doubt about that. But the Russians would prefer that rather than expanding their military by 600,000, to have those 600,000 in the workforce and have that workforce gainfully employed, making things that are good for Russia and good for Russia's economic partners, earning a good solid income, paying taxes, you know, and then getting married and raising kids, lots of kids, because the Russian needs kids. This whole war thing, this whole war footing, it's not good for the health of a nation, the economic health, but also the demographic health. Europe's going to seeing that problem. You see declining birth rates everywhere. This is sort of the danger of immigration, you know, because now you're injecting non-traditional values into, you know, societies that are defined by traditional values. It dilutes the unique character of, you know, nations. Russia has spent 25 years rebuilding what it means to be a Russian. You know, there was a time when Russians were ready to abandon Russia. They were abandoning Russia. They didn't believe in Russia. They had lost faith in Russia. Not today. I have to say, I mean, I'm deeply impressed with the Russians. They're not a perfect society. Nothing is. Nothing's perfect. But they're pretty damn good. I mean, these are people that are, by and large, happy with who they are, happy where they are. Could things be better? Sure. Are they working to make it better? Yeah. But you know, the Russians like being Russian. They're proud of being Russia, and they have a lot to be proud of. I think Russia would like the Europeans to be proud of being who they are too. The Russians don't, you know, hold it against me for being proud American. I mean, some scratch their head and say, well, what are you proud of? And I, you know, say, well, the potential. I think America has more potential than any place in the world, because we're not trapped by our history. We're, you know, we live in a prison of ideas. And if we could just live up to those ideas and those ideals, we could be pretty damn cool. But we're not doing that. So yeah, you know, we're worried, but I love the potential of America. And the Russians are like, cool. Love a guy who loves his country. The Russians love a person who loves their country. They will never hold it against you for saying, I'm a proud American, or I'm a proud Iranian, or I'm a proud Brazilian, or I'm a proud Canadian. They're like, good. You're proud of your country. So are we. And therefore, we have a lot in common. You love your country. I love my country. Let's get along. The Russians are great about this. Europe, not so much anymore. And it's sad. It's sad. I lived in Europe. I grew up in Europe. I grew up in Germany. And I traveled extensively. You know, back in the 80s, I got the Eurail pass, you know, and you throw a backpack on the back and you just go. And for 2 months, I just basically caught trains and camped out and saw all of Europe. And you could drive places, my parents, every time they took a vacation, we'd go to a different place in Europe. It's fantastic. I loved Europe. I loved every aspect of Europe. I loved crossing the border. I loved going from Germany, where I had my German marks, and I had to go into Italy and get the Italian lira. And then, you know, one of the first things you do to get the train station is you go in and you exchange your money and you get the other money. And now you're like in Italy. And I really know I'm in Italy because I have lira. You know, not today. It's all euro. And they've sort of erased the borders. And I know it's supposed to be convenient, but it's sort of, Europe's lost its allure. Lost what it means to be European. Anyways, I babbled on too far about that.